This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Is Earth designed by life for life? Or is this a casino of chance where catastrophe decides who survives? Those questions and more this week with Dr. Peter Ward on Radio EcoShock. I can tell you Peter is a professor at the University of Washington. He's a paleontologist. He's a specialist in the long history of Earth, its climate, and its periods of mass extinction. In my opinion, Peter is also one of the most underestimated minds in American science. I know he'll blush when I say that, but his 11th book shook me. It's called Under a Green Sky, Global Warming, the Mass Extinctions of the Past, and What They Can Tell Us About Our Future. That book presents the best theory we have on the mechanism of great mass extinction, and that was in 2007. 2 years later, he surprises again with the Medea hypothesis, which we'll touch on, and his 2010 book, The Flooded Earth, Our Future in a World Without Ice Caps, stands near my desk as a standard for the public. And in 2015, he published A New History of Life, The Radical New Discoveries About the Origins and Evolution of Life on Earth with Joel Kirschfink. It's radical science. We'll find out why. Peter Ward, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Well, you're right. I am blushing.
Okay, well, I've saved up some serious questions for you over the past few months, which touch on your string of books, and I'd like to begin by revisiting your now 10-year-old theory of how a massive extinction on land and sea creatures happened. Please describe the organisms that created a poisonous atmosphere for a time on Earth.
Well, they say that the meek shall inherit the earth, and I think maybe that is just our underestimation of bacteria as being meek. They certainly run this world in terms of elemental cycling. They run the world in so many different ways. But I guess it's whenever you say don't make Mother Earth really mad, you're really saying don't enrage the bacteria. It's the microbial world which has gathered together to put forward some really nasty characters that in some have been able to produce these global catastrophes.
And you've dived into a lake that had that kind of what I would call anti-ecology, for us at least. What was that like?
Well, there are several of these, actually. The one that I know best is in Palau. It's a series of actually small lakes where on the surface you have these fantastic and marvelous jellyfish. But down beneath, we find a completely different group of organisms. They're microbial. They're scummy, greenish in color, and you're diving down through crystal clear down into this green goo. And you're also diving down from really the metaphor for our modern world, one full of animals, down into a world that was that before animals, the Precambrian world. And these, of all the microbes, are, at least for we animals, the most devastating because they produce hydrogen sulfide, very toxic, that nasty smell from rotten eggs, which is hugely poisonous to us, is produced through normal respiration by these microbes, and it does move upward into the other parts of the lake, so the whole place smells like rotten eggs, at least faintly.
And do we know where these sulfur-based organisms came from? Were they here on Earth before the great oxygenation event, or could they have arrived from outer space?
Well, we certainly know they're among the most ancient organisms on Earth. And any one of us, I know you are located in British Columbia, it's not very hard to go find some. Simply go to a beach, dig down through the sand, even for 6 or 10 inches, and you'll hit this black, gooey layer, and you can smell the noxious sulfur coming out of it. The fossil record of these is very poor, but we have a microbial record that we can use from actually what makes oil, called biomarkers. And we find this oily residue all the way back in rocks over 3 billion years in age. And in fact, some people now believe that these sulfur-producing organisms were at least very close to what the very first organisms on Earth were. Now, whether they came from a meteorite from space or whether they originated here on Earth, you can make arguments either way.
So they're lurking, just waiting for the right conditions. And what are those conditions?
Well, they're strange organisms in that they really thrive in places where there is no oxygen. So this is where we find them on these beach locales. The top 10 or 15 or however many inches of sediment where you find hanging out the clams and worms and all the stuff we're used to, you go down deeper very quickly. If it's a thick, muddy sand, no oxygen can diffuse down into it. And so you find this oxygen-free environment, and that's where these things do best. They cannot live in free oxygen, but they certainly can live in places with very little oxygen, and they do, and they thrive.
All right. Now, on that note, a few weeks ago, I interviewed the Russian scientist Sergei Petrovsky, who's now working in the UK, and his work suggests that phytoplankton, which produce the majority of the world's oxygen, could thrive as warming progresses up to a point, and then many species could go into extinction. There is a tipping point there, he says, and the paper is called Mathematical Modeling of Plankton, Oxygen Dynamics Under Climate Change. Now, if that's true, would that relate to your theory of deadly changes in ocean life?
Well, absolutely. What the really lethal limit for the phytoplankton will be, there's a couple things. One would be there's not enough carbon dioxide. Well, we certainly know that's not the case. But secondly, is temperature. What happens for many of these phytoplankton actually have to have oxygen. We know that the warmer the water is, the less oxygen it can take up. It holds less oxygen. Cold water has lots of oxygen. Warm water doesn't. If we keep warm in the oceans, we lose oxygen out of them. We finally get to a point where there's no oxygen, and you're killing off the vast majority of phytoplankton, which themselves actually thrive in oxygen conditions.
Sergei Petrovsky told us he had not yet checked his model against the paleoclimate record. Peter Ward, are you aware of any dip in world oxygen levels in that record since the great oxygenation event 2.3 billion years ago? Has it happened?
Oh, yes, it's happened multiple times. Each of the great mass extinctions, in fact, of the last 500 million years has been proximately caused by a reduction in oxygen. And we find these conditions which cause oxygen to go down are themselves related to enormous changes in the geological history of the planet. If you have a case where you are suddenly exposing, let's say, lots of minerals that are already reduced, in other words, they haven't been turned to rust. So let's say we have lots of iron before we put it in oxygen and let any water go near it. Expose lots of iron-rich sediment that is in that chemical state, and you draw oxygen right out of the atmosphere. The history of the Earth showed this early on. We have huge deposits of what are called banded iron deposits, and in fact, the richest iron deposits that we find around Lake Superior and much of Canada were deposited over a billion years ago in conditions with very low oxygen. So we know that this has periodically happened. In the last 500 million years, the lowest that oxygen got was about 10%. It's 21% now. So it hasn't gone down to zero in the last at least 600 or 700 million years.
Okay, I'd like to move on to a question that touches on your book, The Flooded Earth. In Robert Scribler's blog, he's just a blog that I love to read, Robert Marston Fanny says sea level rise has accelerated, quote, from 2009 through October 2015, global oceans have risen by 5 millimeters per year. And he cites data in a graph from Aviso, A-V-I-S-O, the satellite altimetry data site. But on the other hand, Peter, a very new science has come out suggesting a drier state of land is soaking up more moisture than before, limiting sea level rise. And that comes from work by J.T. Rager, a researcher with NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. So we have two different points of view here. Peter, what do you see happening in this matter of short-term sea level rise?
Well, there's far more than two. I think you're probably going to have a point of view from virtually every scientist who looks out there. I mean, the nice thing about those two examples is they're both really interesting examples of, first, how good our equipment is. Can you imagine that you're able to measure through satellite technology such a tiny change in sea level? But secondly, the other aspect that the land is drier, I don't think many people have really touched on that in the past. It's just one more example of how complicated it is to arrive at conclusions. I personally would be very much afraid of trying to make any sort of conclusion on a five-year record. Sea level rise is so slow. And the bigger problem with sea level rise is it happens at different rates in different places. The West Coast of North America has a much different sea level rise than, say, the East Coast of North America does, and a difference, again, from the Gulf of Mexico, and very much different from the Indo-Pacific. So it's complicated.
And we found this with temperature. It isn't so much the global mean that matters. It's what happens where you are in the different regions and different countries. I guess the same is true of sea level, just the way you describe it.
Yep. They say that all politics is local. Well, so is all environmental change. Really, you go back to ever smaller areas, and certainly the sea level rise conundrum is facing different countries with different aspects of the equation. In the long run, and by the long run, I mean certainly over the next century, everybody is going to be affected by it, and there's no going back. It's certainly not going to start going down again. But the question about rates is just that, which we touched upon, that we need longer periods of observation to really understand the trends. And the other thing is there's always seemingly some brand new bit of data, just like that dry and land aspect, that perhaps slightly changes things. It's the long scale picture, and here is our biggest problem, because no politician is going to think in 50-year intervals. And when we start thinking about what is going to be the future of the human race over the next centuries, like trying to get anyone to think about this, one of the great tragedies of recent history, I think, is going to go down is this recent U.S. Supreme Court ruling. This is a disaster. I mean, this will be, I think, marked in history in the future as one of the great disasters.
Can you tell our overseas listeners what that ruling was?
Yes, the United States, after a huge amount of negotiation back and forth, and one of the really brave acts of the Obama administration, worked out a deal with China. And these, as the two biggest emitters of carbon dioxide, made an actual agreement that would slow the rise of greenhouse gases. We're not saying anything about stopping it. We're just trying to slow the rise. But even that was struck down by the U.S. Supreme Court. And what was so surprising about that ruling is that the normal business of the U.S. Supreme Court is to make rulings when lower courts have made a decision. But this was a highly politicized move by the Republican-led faction of the U.S. Supreme Court. It was a 5-4 decision, and they made this ruling even before lower courts had decided upon it. This is such a slap in the face. It is also a signal that the full court would definitely remove these particular conditions. Now, the wild card, of course, is the death of the most conservative of the Supreme Court justices, Scalia. But this, in a way, will make things even worse, because now we're going to have 4-4 votes in all probability. And when there is a 4-4 vote, the prior rulings are just left in place.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex. My guest from the West Coast is Dr. Peter Ward, scientist, author, and expert in past extinctions. He's from the University of Washington. Moving on, starting in the 1700s, as you know very well, scientists, especially geologists, described the world as a gradual continuum where the present is the key to the past. The opposite theory, called catastrophism, was left for fringe writers like Immanuel Velikovsky, maybe. But where does your new book, A New History of Life, fit in?
Well, I guess that makes me a fringe writer. Darn it. I was always suspicious of that. It's interesting. Another so-called fringe writer was a man named Lamarck, who was an evolutionist way back during the French Revolution. And just as we are starting to see revolutionary new ideas about geology, so too we're beginning to understand some very revolutionary new ideas about evolution that themselves interact very much so with this whole idea of catastrophism. I personally think that what we call uniformitarianism, and there's a word that will make you a lot of money in a Scrabble tournament, uniformitarianism suggests that to understand anything of the past, you have to invoke modern-day processes. But I was just thinking about these past mass extinctions. Let's think about a world where the surface of the oceans is filled with these tiny microbes that produce hydrogen sulfide. There is no ocean on the planet that shows that. I mean, the closest thing we have is the Black Sea, and yet even there, we still have a pretty thick oxygen layer up on top, enough for fish. Well, trying to invoke uniformitarianism to understand these times of very low oxygen surface oceans just can't be done. trying to understand what happens after a giant meteor impact, the effect it has on climate, that just can't be done. There are case after case after case where you just cannot use the modern to understand the past. And unfortunately, there are case after case where I think we won't be able to use the modern to understand future history as well.
And I presume this new book also originates from your earlier work, The Medea Hypothesis. Talk to us about your ongoing argument with James Lovelock and the Gaia Hypothesis.
Well, much of that comes, again, from this idea about uniformitarianism. But the Gaia Hypothesis comes in several forms. It goes from what they call extreme Gaia, where the most extreme Gaia Hypothesis or theory, as Lovelock says, is that the Earth itself is a superorganism and is alive. Going back down the scale, much of what the Gaia Hypothesis research did, though, was very good. We began to understand a great deal about carbon cycling. We know much more about how nitrogen and other elements move through systems, and much of that was really stimulated by Lovelock and other ideas. Lovelock was trying to understand how atmospheres respond to the presence of life. But the scary thing to me about Gaia was this idea that life would fix it, that we can break the atmosphere by chemically changing it, and that life would find a way, as they said in Jurassic Park, old Dr. Malcolm, to bring it back into an equilibrium that's better for life. I really don't think that's the case.
And how does your new history of life, what does it say about Darwin and the theory of evolution as the primary narrative of life's development on Earth?
Well, one of the real interesting and, to me, in a way, scary aspects of biological research has been the research into a field called epigenetics, not just plain genetics, as Mendel first originated, but epigenetics suggests that something entirely non-Darwinian. Darwin, as we know, said that the way that organisms evolve is that you have natural selection, that an organism will produce more offspring, a species will produce more individuals than its environment can hold. There are just too many, and some will die. But Darwin never thought that any change that could happen in your life, other than your own death, would affect evolution. What if, for instance, something in your life completely changed your genes, so that if that event had not happened, you would have children that are different than they otherwise were? Well, this is what epigenetics is suggesting, that there are subtle and sometimes not so subtle changes to our sperm and our eggs that are produced by events in our lifetime. Darwin rolls over in his grave over and over and over every time a new research topic in this comes out, and increasingly it's being shown that this is the case.
So how would you describe this book for us?
Anytime you try to tell yourself that something is new, pretty much you'll find out from your audience that, no, it's not new. Someone already found it out a long time ago. And there's the hubris in trying to say that you're trying to do something differently. Luckily or happily, some of the predictions that we've made and I've made in the past are coming true, but most unhappily for me, others of them are really coming true. In 1994, I published a book that was called The End of Evolution, and certainly this epigenetics is suggesting that evolution is changing. It's certainly not the end. That wasn't my title, that was the publisher's. But the prediction back in 94 that we would see a drastic decrease in overall biodiversity has certainly been held up in the recent book, The Sixth Extinction, is just a replaying of that 94 book of mine over and over, and it's unfortunately the case. So what we try to do in this new book is to marshal, based on the newest scientific discoveries, ideas about the origin of life, about how early life was challenged by changing atmosphere, trying to look at what lower and higher oxygen meant during the period when animals first appeared, and trying to give some predictions then, both about the future, but also pointing out the greatest dangers affecting the biosphere and how atmospheric change, much as like we're seeing now, are themselves a terrible, terrible portent.
I want to talk to you about something rather strange about Google and the way the web tends to warp things. When I talk with some of the world's top scientists, and I do, it's not uncommon for them to mention your theories, and Radio EcoShock listeners ask about you. You've been on PBS, Coast to Coast AM, you helped Animal Planet. But if I Google Peter Ward and climate, the top couple of pages refer to a man who really is on the fringe of climate science. Do you know who I'm talking about?
Absolutely. There's a funny story. He's pretty unhappy with me. And we, at the annual meeting of the Geological Society of America, the other Peter Ward, who certainly doesn't hold views that I subscribe to, had a talk, and he had was given one of the prime slots, and the room filled up, and he stood up, and then people were saying, wait a minute, that's not Peter Ward. And others of my friends were going, my God, Peter, you've gone mad. Why are you espousing this crazy idea? What is wrong with you? We have to use our middle names. Mine's D. I think his is J. Yeah, we run into each other, and it used to be sort of funny, but he doesn't see the humor in it anymore. He seems rather angry, as a matter of fact.
Well, listeners, Dr. Peter Langdon Ward is a volcano expert, and he brings out the theory that volcanic eruptions and depletion of ozone and chlorinated substances cause global warming and not fossil fuels. So, yeah, definitely a fringe case. Do you think, Peter Ward, the real Peter Ward, that human greenhouse gas emissions have stopped the next scheduled ice age from happening?
I really suspect so, and I think most climate scientists are also in that point of view. Just, we really understand them. It still amazes me how such a small change in a number of molecules in air can have such a world-changing effect. I mean, we're talking about hundreds to thousands of molecules among the untold billions. When you're talking about parts per million or parts per thousand, and the slight changes that can cause atmospheric carbon dioxide change to produce huge, huge climate effects, it's so surprising to me how unbelievably powerful carbon dioxide is, and even more so methane. This is why this leak that I'm surprised has not gotten more press, this gigantic methane leak that has been taking place in California for months, has received so little press play, really. And yet, this is a catastrophe of great, great size.
Wow, I agree with you. Okay, now, if life bumbles along through these long periods between catastrophes, and the catastrophes may be of life's own making, where do you think we are now? Are we on the edge of a next mass extinction, or could that be thousands of years from now?
Well, I think you hit the right idea that I think life in some ways is like the redoubtable British. You know, they're going to bumble right through it and get through it. We are producing huge negative effects, but at the same time, there are so many people, and I will take the moment to make you blush, such as yourself, who are doing so much to make things better, that through science and through education and through just a change in consciousness, people are changing the way they live, that we are reducing our footprint. Both are happening at the same time. There are more and more humans, obviously, and this is causing great changes on the planet. And yet the rate at which people are understanding the negativity that we can do in large numbers, I think, is also helping things get better.
Okay, for me, one of the huge questions is knowing what we know is whether global warming is reversible. If we could find a technology or change civilization so that we reduce carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, maybe even get to those pre-industrial levels of 280 parts per million, could the coming catastrophe be averted, or is it already in unstoppable play?
Well, some parts are unstoppable, some aren't. Let's pretend that we just shut down all greenhouse gases right now. I mean, obviously, volcanoes are going to still do what volcanoes do, but let's go pre-industrial. As you know, we have lots of things that will take up carbon dioxide, and certainly the oceans have been really saving the collective human butt, if I can use that word, for some time now, because ocean is able to absorb so much of the carbon dioxide we produce. But we've already built into the sea level system, I believe it's from a half meter to as much as a meter of sea level rise that is in place, that whether we put another CO2 molecule in the atmosphere or not is still going to happen. We're still going to get that 1 meter rise. And there's nobody, no one, who thinks that we're going to be able to shut it all down. We can't shut down human population growth. We are what? We're heading towards 7 billion very quickly. And the best hope is we only hit 9 billion, but there are a lot of people who still think we'll hit 11 billion. Even if we have entirely renewable resources, that many people is going to produce a huge footprint on this planet. So it's a race, really. It's a race between this population growth and the scientific and engineering, and if I dare say, the social fabric of our planet, where we get enough people in enough powerful enough positions to make the changes that are necessary. And then I go back once again to this most unfortunate U.S. Supreme Court decision. Because if the U.S. backs out of even the pitiful amount of climate change understanding that this one accord was to put forward, why would India and China, which are the two other giant players, or even Europe as a whole, why would they go ahead and try to match U.S. goals here? So that, to me, this is, again, a watershed moment in not U.S. history, that too, but in global history.
You know, I feel a sense of schizophrenia. Along with you, I see the signs that we are ruining the climate, that we need to live. But in the meantime, life can be lots of fun. I get up and do what most people do. How do you deal with that dichotomy?
There are good days and bad days, just like anybody else. And I think the best one can do is say, I don't have a magic wand, but I certainly have a footprint. And I just try to keep my footprint as small as I can. I have to tell myself to quit lecturing because I can be a scold, and nobody likes to be a scold. I think the world can have many scolds as long as they hold out some hope. It's scolding without recourse to hope that I think is even a greater disaster.
And as we wrap up, is there anything else you'd like to talk to us about? Maybe your current research or science that excites you, anything?
Well, one thing I've been trying to do on small scales is, this is not saving the world, but it's trying to save one species. I began my work with the chambered nautilus, and I have been, over these last 5 years, been going out over and over and over again. There was an interesting news article on my work last summer called Rare Nautilus Seen After 30 Years. The sad, scary thing to me is that where that very strange, different nautilus, one that I named, in matter of fact, is called Allonautilus, the other nautilus, is found around the eastern side of Papua New Guinea, a place called Manus Island. And coincidentally, that area is about to be mined for the first time in enormous fashion by a Canadian company called Nautilus Minerals. How's that for irony? They're going to go down and grab up entire metalliferous hydrothermal vents from deep water. They have put out what I think is a ridiculous environmental statement saying that they will have no effect on the very fragile ecosystems out there. And they, frankly, just do not really seem to want to be criticized. So what got me going, two teenage kids, and then when they were grade school kids, started a website and a fundraiser called SaveTheNautilus.com. And what they're doing with that money is they have been funding researchers to go out and look at the chambered nautilus and try to understand should it get more protections. Now, they funded part of my trips, but others as well. And these are kids that are taking a dollar at a time from their friends and putting together little bits of money. But it's that sort of mentality. Let's go out and do what we can. And so they've inspired me to try to make a case for international protection of not just the nautilus, that beautiful seashell, but lots of other invertebrates that don't get the press that the rhinos and the lions and tigers do. So SaveTheNautilus.com, two kids trying to make a difference. It's a website. It's very inspiring.
Okay, we've been speaking with Dr. Peter Ward. He's a paleontologist, professor at the University of Washington, author of more than a dozen books. His latest book is A New History of Life, The Radical New Discoveries About the Origins and Evolution of Life on Earth. I can't think of a more important topic. You can find my previous interviews with Peter and all sorts of follow-up links in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Peter, thank you so much for joining us again.
As always, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you.
I've enjoyed it too. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.